We have the tremendous good fortune to learn Maseches Tevilin this year, and Maseches Tevilin has a lot to offer us, like every Masechta does, but there are unique opportunities. This is a Masechta that's very relevant to our practical lives, even if we're not actually Shulchan, and even if we don't actually get involved in the process, but it certainly affects our lives, affects a lot of what we do. And this is true both practically and philosophically. And the concept of Shechita, which we're going to start with today, is maybe like every mitzvah in the Torah, but maybe more so, is going to interact with a possible theme and, if possible, hashgafic points, which happen to be relevant to this parasha. Hashgafic points, the parasha A, is the week that we begin learning the Sefer Torah. And we'd like to first start off by trying to see how we can discern some of the major themes, both halakhically, lumdish-wise, and hashgafically. They're all going to be interwoven in the concept of Shechita. And even though this is going to be an introduction, we're going to jump right into the Mishnah. I happen to think, when you see the Rishonim at the beginning of every Masechta, the beginning of many Masechta, the beginning of many Prakim, the Rishonim will ask, why did the Mishnah start this way? Why was the Mishnah arranged that this is the opening theme? And there's always answers, but I tend to think, whether it's true or not, but it's something that at least is open for discussion, that very often you can find that the first Mishnah in the Masechta contains the sozos of that theme. And so there are very basic fundamental ideas that can be figured out from the Mishnah. And it's an interesting question to ask here, why the Mishnah starts the way it does. We just picked up the Sefer a few weeks ago, actually forgot the title, I don't know what it's called, but the author of the Sefer goes through the Shulchan Aruch and the Torah and various Dvarim, why they're organized the way they are, and he explains what the most logical system of organizing a halakhic work is, what are the kind of basics that you would want to start with and continue with. So here, what about the Mishnah? So the fact that the Mishnah, what's the first din that we are told about Hilchos Shechita? Sorry?
Yeah.
Yes, who? Who can do it? Right, we're not, before we even know what Shechita is, which is clearly important, and before we know other details of Shechita, the first thing we get is, who is it who can shech? And the Mishnah tells us, Hakol Shochtim, that everyone can shech, and the Shechita is going to be acceptable. Chutz mecher shot of the cotton, right? Excusing, accepting certain categories, those who are kind of deficient in das on some level, a fair shot of the cotton, but as a reason, it's not necessarily a fundamental exclusion. Shema yekalkulu esh shchitasan, maybe they're going to mess up. The kulon sheshachtu, but all of them, if they shachtu v'acherim ro'onosan, shchitasan kishero. So then if others have watched it, the shchita is going to be kasher. So why do you think this din is the appropriate way, might be a particularly appropriate way to start this chapter? And acknowledge that there's a logic to it, okay, and that's the paper I was mentioning that points out that it's a logical place to start, any halacha, okay, who does it? But maybe there's a little bit more that we can glean from this. Why is this a very relevant din to start with? What do you look like you want to
think? Kulin is meaning we're dealing with,
Okay. So Shechita for sure we want to talk about.
Right. So, we want to know who we're speaking to.
Okay, right. But is that all the dinim we could talk about when it comes to Shechita? So is there something that this particularly speaks to? Yeah? Okay, so then what would you make of the fact that it doesn't start with that? What's most important?
Well, I guess knowing what to do is definitely more important than that.
So why? Yeah, why is that so significant? Why is that something that deserves starting with?
Because it's
Thank you. So therefore, because of its broad, so that, okay, interesting. But what does this tell us? Other than, what does this tell us other than itself? Right, other than, or what does it address? It's maybe it's too, it's jumping to the conclusion to say what it tells us. But what does this address other than itself? Other than the detail of who is actually going to be Schechter? Bringing up that topic, what does that tell us? What does it address? Maybe you could suggest that the relevance of this topic goes to the question of what is tshuva, not just in terms of how do you do it or what does it involve practically. But we know that when you have mitzvot, when you have actual obligations, so those obligations, usually it's relevant who's doing them. Is this something that everyone is obligated to do? Is this something that is only going to be effective if certain people do it because they are obligated? Is it a means to an end? Does it have any inherent holiness to it, the way it's done? Would you say, for example, when it comes to a Sefer Torah, that anyone can write a Sefer Torah? Just anyone can write tefillin. So that's interesting, right? What's the difference? Is there a difference? Yeah, maybe. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm just bringing the term right now, but there are some instances where the result is what matters.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter how it was done. It could have been done without proper kavanah, let's say. But
okay.
As long as it was done.
So already we see some important things coming out there, right? Is Kavanah going to play a role, right? Is this a focus on the result, or is it something where the action matters, right? Is it different from the Sefer Torah? Is it different from Kavanos, especially because of what that connects with the Kavanos? Is there anyone else speaking? Ah, so that's already the Mishnah is addressing that, right, or is hinting at that,
right.
Because first we excluded Chayr Shot of the Cotton. So you might say, okay, well that's not so surprising because Chayr Shot of the Cotton is Pater from Mitzvot. Right? So if we're going to say that a Chayr Shot of the Cotton is excluded, so then yeah, the Chayr Shot of the Cotton in general doesn't eat the matzah, it doesn't have to put on tefillin. It is exempt from Mitzvot in general. But then, what Sam is pointing out is, well, not fundamentally excluded, it's just there's a practical concern that maybe something will go wrong. And then the Mishnah comes back and says, in fact, if we're watching, maybe it is doable. So the fact that we're saying not only is there a very broad acceptability, but the acceptability even goes beyond those who are chayav in mitzvot at all, that seems to say that there's something about this, that it's not necessarily a mitzvah in the sense of other mitzvahs. And that, as Levi was saying, maybe it's more result-oriented. But does that mean it's purely practical? Recall 2 years ago, we learned sukkah. So sukkah is a requirement for who can build a sukkah?
No.
A non-Jew, can he build a sukkah? He actually can.
Yeah.
Right? So here how a non-Jew fits in, we're going to have to see. It's an interesting question. But a sukkah we saw at the time, those who were old enough to remember, so when it comes to sukkah, there's some interesting discussions to be had whether a sukkah is just something you need to have in order to fulfill the mitzvah of eating in a sukkah, or is there a mitzvah of building a sukkah, or is there some kind of in-between status? So bringing up this question of who can do the shechita is actually very fundamental, because we want to understand what is shechita about. Is shechita a means to an end? Is it a way to solve a problem? Is it a mitzvah of some kind? Is it somewhere in between? Is it like everything? What's the right answer to everything? Machlokas? Is it a machlokas on some level? Is the machlokas a practical difference? Is it a semantic difference? So trying to understand what shechita is as far as the framework of our religious obligation is very much the question at hand. And by saying who it is who can chef, so the Mishnah is addressing this. It's saying that we don't seem to require somebody who's obligated in mitzvot, but we seem to have some concern. And picking up that question forces us to try to understand what exactly shechita is as far as what our philosophy is. And we'll see that, and we've got a sense a little bit from the Makoros, that there is some discussion about this, perhaps a lot of discussion. And what we'll ultimately see, probably not today, but maybe tomorrow, is that this may very much tie in to what the whole message of Shechita is and what the value is. And that'll help us understand our parasha also. So when you go home and your parents say, I'm Shiva, always going to understand the parasha. Understanding the parasha is going to be very relevant to trying to understand this concept and kind of dancing around the word mitzvah, because you don't yet know whether it is a mitzvah. So this topic seems to be taken up by the Rishonim, even though it's not clear yet what they are trying to say. But the question of shechita as a mitzvah or not a mitzvah is addressed sometimes head-on, sometimes less than head-on by the Rishonim. And it's just the whole question of mitzvot in general, just to say a word about. So we have a tradition that there are 613 mitzvot. Is that tradition absolute? It's an interesting question. Not all the Rishonim thought it was absolute. It's primarily known from the Gemara in the end of Masechet Makos, where the Gemara tells us that there's some law who said there are 613 mitzvot. And the effort to count the mitzvot primarily occurs during the time of the Rishonim. You don't have it earlier, and you don't really have it later. Earlier, we don't have a full listing of what those 613 are. And in the era of the Achronim, so we all, there are many, 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 many Sfarim written about the Sifrei HaMitzvos, but they're all building on what was done in the time of the Rishonim. So in the time of the Rishonim, there was an effort to count the mitzvot. So who counted that mitzvot among the Rishonim? The Rambam, very primarily, very notably. Who else? Sorry? Right. Also, okay, right. So we have a number of anonymous ones. In addition to the Rambam, so we have Sefer Achinuch, who is possibly anonymous also. So Sefer Achinuch, we may or may not know. There's some argument about whether we know who wrote the Sefer Achinuch, but certainly the Sefer Achinuch is up there as far as those who counted the mitzvot. And we have the Baha'i counted mitzvot, and the Smag, and the Smak. So we have a number of efforts among the era of the early Rishonim, the later Rishonim, to count up the mitzvot. And since then, we comment on them. So now we have Achronim, who wrote the many, many commentaries on the Sefer Mitzvot of the Rambam. We have Sefer Mitzvot of the Sadragon, which we'll make reference to maybe today. That's a fascinating Sefer, the way it's presented today, because the Sadragon wrote a poem, essentially, counting the mitzvot. And if you want to get a hold of it today, you have to buy a huge three-volume Sefer, because there was a very learned businessman by the name of Yerucham Tishaferla, a wonderful role model, a tremendous, tremendous Tamakafa. And he wrote this huge three-volume work. And all it says in the cover is Sefer Mitzvah Kulasad. You wouldn't know that there was anything else. But the beer of Yerucham Tishaferla is a tremendous Sefer. So there's a lot that has been built upon this foundation of the Rishonim trying to count up the mitzvot. And one could say, does it matter? Does the whole question matter? Why exert all this effort to count up the mitzvot? Okay, there are 613. Does it matter how you count them? And is it even agreed upon? The Ramban in some places raises the possibility that this is one opinion in the Gemara, and it's not necessarily true. You know, that sometimes Rishonim and Tosfos in a few places raises the question that when there's a machlokes about a certain mitzvah, a certain pasuk, whether it constitutes a chiyuv or not, so a Tosfos sometimes raises the question, well, according to this one, how does the count stay consistent if you're going to say this is, this isn't, so then what happens to 613? You know, I'm bound in a few places, so maybe there aren't 613, or maybe the count's not going to really have so much of an impact. I remember many years ago seeing a book in the library here, the title was something like, the concept of Tayag and why bother? Why does it matter to try to count up? So here one might think also, okay, so we see Rishonim say, it is a mitzvah, it is a mitzvah. Is that a semantic difference? Is it a question of keeping our lists straight? Or is there more to it? So I think it's going to be the case, I say this before looking at what the Rishonim say, but I think probably it is important because we have to define what we mean by a mitzvah, that'll be part of our discussion, but counting it or not counting it or putting it in one category or the other presumably affects how you relate to this mitzvah, how you relate to this concept, how you perceive and how you process what the Torah is telling us about Shkita. There may be semantic differences in what you call a mitzvah and what you don't, and that's a large part of, if you read the Rambam, the Sefer HaMitzvos, and in the beginning, so he has the Shrushim, he has his principles as to what he counts and what he doesn't count, and the Ramban has a lot to say about that. So much to say about it that I didn't put the Ramban's comment about Shita on the Manukomot, because I would have spent all morning trying to find it, so it's a short line, so we'll refer to it outside. But the way you count the mitzvot says something about how you relate to these concepts, and it does have an impact, both in terms of sometimes halachic nafkaminas, in terms of practical differences, but also in terms of whatever the value, the message that the mitzvah is trying to tell us is going to be tied in to how you understand what a mitzvah is. And the Kulin is uniquely appropriate for us to try to investigate that. Okay, so that being said, so who comments on this among the Rishonim? What do we see in terms of the possibilities of how to relate to Shechita, to mitzvah, something else? Somewhere in between. Who took sides on this? Okay, it's the Rambam. So what does the Rambam say? Rambam in a few places. He counts it as a mitzvah, right? In Kuf Mem Vav. Those of you who looked at Kuf Mem Vav, you saw that was P.O.D., typo of the day, try to keep you on your feet by the extra credit challenge to try to make the typo fit into what was meant to be said. You know, sometimes great creativity comes from those constraints, but it's actually Kuf Mem Vav. So the Rambam there counts Shechita as a mitzvah, as one of the 613. And you also, in Mishneh Torah, says this. In Mishneh Torah, in Hilchos Shechita, in Parak Aleph, Mishneh Aleph, he has language there, which if you don't read carefully, could sound like extreme vegan activism. Right, because how could you misread that first line? Right, so this called Mishiyotzer Afal Basar. If somebody wants to eat meat, so you should check it. So that's a pretty extreme pita type of perspective. We don't pass them like that. We should not check people for eating meat. But what he's actually saying is somebody who wants to eat meat, so it's a mitzvah for him to check. So here you have the Rambam calling it a mitzvah, and others disagree. So who among them disagreed? The Raiva. The Raiva is a little hard to find because it's on the comment on the Sefer HaMitzvot. And there it's also, you have to look in the bottom of the quote. But what's the Raiva's position about this counting? So to put Shechita as a mitzvah, what's the Raiva's understanding? Yeah. So it's a lot about mitzvah. Right, so exactly. So that essentially this shouldn't be seen as a positive mitzvah. It should be seen as a lot that even though the Torah doesn't phrase it as a prohibition, the Torah does not say don't eat non-shechted meat, although maybe it says something close to that. And by the way, we're kind of skipping over a pretty fundamental step here. Referring to Parshas Re'eh, and almost deliberately not looking at the Pesukim yet, because there's a lot to say about the Pesukim, and hopefully we'll do that a little more tomorrow. It sounds like we're skipping something pretty basic here by not looking at the Pesukim, but the reason why I want to get into that with some introduction first. But ostensibly, what seems to be the mafia that we're arguing over is the Pasuk in Re'eh, the Davafta, that you shall chef like you have been commanded, and that itself is a mysterious phrase. We're going to get to it more, because that's one of the major indications of an oral tradition of the Torah Shabbatah, because there is this Tzibur. But we'll get to that. But the Torah is essentially, according to what the Ravid is saying, is essentially saying that, no, don't look at this as if there's any positive value in shechting, but that there would be an isser to eat something that is not shechting. There's an isser of einos buche. To eat something that is not shechting should be viewed as a prohibition, and it's one that is inferred from the positive language of the Torah. So essentially, what the Torah is saying is don't not chef food that you're going to eat. So according to the writer, don't see that as a positive mitzvah, and instead see it as, by exclusion, telling us what you can eat. And in terms of the framework that we're saying, you see, it seems like the writer is basically saying, don't look at shechita as a positive value, look at it as something that just tells us a negative value about eating that which is not shechita. And there are those who would see it maybe as even less than what the Ravid is saying. So who could be counted maybe in that club, seeing it as maybe even less? So let's talk about Tosfos. Is complicated. Let's try to give a little background on the Tosfos. This is a complicated Tosfos. It's a Tosfos in two places. Takes this up. I don't know if you saw the Tosfos in Beit Zah. Both complicated. We'll try to give a little background. So Tosfos in Shavuos, and that's the Balad and Aleph, and Tosfos in Beit Zah also take up this question. Agav, something else, because they're trying to figure out the interaction between the various Isurim. And there are a number of prohibitions that can be involved in eating meat. One could violate an isser of Eivor Min HaChai. One would take a limb from a living animal. And very notably, and this will come back to also, that would be true, that it would be prohibited whether you're Jewish or not. This is one of the Sheva Mitzvahs from Noah. This is something which apparently taps into an even more universal value, that to eat something that is from a living animal is very fundamentally prohibited, very universally prohibited. There is a concept of nevela, that an animal that dies of itself is prohibited, that we know also. So where does shechita fit into this picture? Is shechita creating another concept here, or is it something else? And how do these different concepts interact? So Tosfos, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this part, just to give you the context also, so that when you saw the Tosfos to understand what's going on. So Tosfos in Shavuos was dealing with the concept of Ein Isser Chaval Isser, that one prohibition does not take effect on top of another prohibition. So the question is, are there exceptions to that? What if they both come at the same time? If they are interacting in various ways. So the Gemara tries to figure out, Rishonim try to figure out the relationship between the Isser of Eivor Min HaChai and a potential other din that is associated with shechita. So it's in that context that Tosfos brings up those other issues, of Eivor Min HaChai, and when does it kick in? Does it kick in when the animal is fully intact, or only after a limb would be separated from an animal? Etc. So that's the background of why Tosfos is talking about it. But there, Tosfos presents two positions. One, that essentially there is an Isser Aseh here, like the Ravid said. Or, like the Ritva quoted in posters over there, that there is not even that. That essentially all Shchita is, don't even count it as a negative value. But that simply we have an Isser, and in order for it to become Mutter, this is what you have to do. So it's what you might call a matir, something that only exists to remove a problem, but shouldn't even be given significance beyond that. Well, there's an Isser feed meat that hasn't been ingested, maybe because it's Nevela, maybe because they've been Machaya, maybe some combination of the two. And the only way it's going to be permissible is for you to shest it.
Is that different? Is that
yeah, because there is an Isser anyway, and that's part of what they're showing in the grappling way. Because right? You say, presumably, that if you're going to mean you're going to eat an animal that's alive, that's a Machaya. And if the animal died some other way, then it's Nevela. So what do I need to say there's any additional concept coming from the Zavakta Keshir Tzivitifa other than to say that this is the path to make it Mutter. But it doesn't necessarily have any inherent religious value. It's just the only way that you're going to be able to eat this. We know that in general there's basically, obviously many more questions, but there's basically a three-part test. If one wants to eat meat, not for 9 days or whatever, then you're going to get there, but set aside all those other issues. But one wants to eat meat, it's basically a three-part test that you have to go through. First of all, is the animal itself a kosher species?
So a matir is
neither a low-cost thing. That's what it would seem like. You know, it's just a functional meat, mm-hmm. And it's a problem. You know, basically, there's like a you know, it's as if the cops towed my car, so I need to get it back in order to drive, but there's no significance to what I'm doing to get it. Right now there's a boot on the car or whatever it is, there's an impediment to my being able to do it, and maybe I just need to get that impediment out of the way and do that. But just to think about a three-part test, you know, the first question is always, first of all, is this a kosher species, like a behemoth maya or a behemoth ahara. Then, if we've established, with the flowchart, if we've established that, yes, it is a kosher animal, next question is, okay, but this animal, is it fit? So maybe the animal is a traitor. Maybe the animal has some kind of inherent problem. That's going to be a topic of a later parish in very detail in the Sefer Tzvuah. And then, if the animal is not a traitor, if the animal is both a kosher species and this example of the animal is fit to be eaten, so then it has to go through the process of shchita, that's the next step, or if not, if that doesn't happen, so then the animal's still not going to be acceptable to eat. So we have that three-part process, but maybe that's not necessarily reflective of mitzvot, per se, but maybe the first one
would. Would it be so simple to say that if an action is a matir, that it wouldn't necessarily be a mitzvah in and of itself, because I know there's many times you stand in Bethel's kitchen or something.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so you have
to mitzvah versus matir. But
uh-huh.
a lot of the times where the action falls in the category of matir is still considered to be part of the mitzvah.
Right. So the good question is the term, and part of what I think we're going to have to be open to here is that we're going to have to maybe create more categories within categories, because maybe things are not true across the board. So what are some examples of the matir that come to mind? Let's say from
I'm trying to remember if get itself.
So get itself is part of the question, right? So if you talk about counting, and this is somewhat of a parallel discussion, you talk about counting the concept of gerushin as a mitzvah. So would anyone say there's a need to divorce one's wife just so we can fulfill the mitzvah of gerushin? So Meister is also, well, Meister is a little bit more to work with. It sounds like it's got a mitzvah quality to it, but yet, what if somebody doesn't want to eat any? Right, so there are a lot of concepts where this kind of issue comes up, and I think we have to be open to the possibility that they don't all line up perfectly, that there may be differences between them.
Uh-huh.
So eating in the sukkah is also an interesting question, because it shifts over the course of the Yom Tov.
Yeah.
Right, so let's say if you, on the first night of Sukkot, so we know there is a mitzvah to eat in the Sukkot. What about in the middle of Sukkot? So is there any mitzvah at all? Or do we say that, no, that if you want to eat, then you have to do it this way. Feel free not to eat. But if you want to eat, then it's got to be this way, and therefore should you see that as any kind of a positive mitzvah? Or to compare it to Chametz and Pesach? Say that there's a mitzvah to eat matzah after the first night, after the Seder? Or is it just the only way you're allowed to have your parts, but it doesn't necessarily reflect any kind of a positive value? Right?
I was just said that the matzah, you have the money to receive the bracha.
Ah, so the bracha clearly seems to be worthy of attention. Why are we making a bracha on? Because, and we'll get to this, but just the fact that everyone acknowledges the bracha, so what are we going to do with that? That's going to be an important question.
Mm-hmm.
The first. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which is a very interesting question in general, the relationship between those two. And we spent some time on that 2 years ago trying to figure out why there are differences. You know, on the one hand, it's a whole different figure. It's worth mentioning just for the complexity and to show that these don't all fit into new categories, that we have more sources in some perspective that says that there's a mitzvah to eat matzah all of Pesach than that there's a mitzvah to sit in the sukkah all of Sukkot. Yet, when it comes to Sukkot, we make a bracha every time we sit in the sukkah, and we don't make a bracha every time we eat matzah. So, what? So how exactly to perceive those differences, which seem to push us in two different directions, is itself interesting. Definitely.
Is there what's the difference between an action and a matzah?
That's a great question also. So to go back to the sukkah example, so when it comes to a hechsher mitzvah, literally speaking, a hechsher mitzvah, you know, which I have to figure out exactly if there's a precise definition of a hechsher mitzvah, but a hechsher mitzvah sounds like it means something that isn't the mitzvah itself, but you can't get to the mitzvah without it. So you need to do this to get to the mitzvah. And once you have such a category, it's possible there's a distinction between them. So in the context of sukkah, it's already throwing that around, getting a little bit of our yentl cell separations in the same time, so we'll build a synergy. So in general, when we choose seasonal yentl topics throughout the year, we try to pick topics that somehow connect to the mitzvah. So maybe sukkah's time, or we'll find time to focus on sukkah as the mitzvah quality of sukkah, because whatever can build on these things. But when it comes to sukkah, so the mitziv is machadish, that there's a different stage in the middle. That there's, on the one hand, mitzvot that has inherent religious value. On the other hand, a hechsher mitzvah that's just a means to an end. But there's also an in-between category, that some hechsher mitzvahs are more significant inherently than others. And he highlighted those that are mentioned to in the Torah in some level, the hechsher mitzvah of Suva Bakra, and they may take on a different status. So it's also relevant to Levi's point that even when we talk in a matir, we talk about putting in that category, there might be a lot of gradations in the middle. So far, what do we have? Yeah, well, in general, Chayrish Rekha Vekhaitan is considered to be a category that indicates a lack of das. So lack of das, in other contexts, may mean that's not subject to using the Gezurim. But here, it sounds like the Mishnah is telling us that it's more of a practical concern of insufficient das, that maybe they're just not going to do a good job. Well, what do you mean by lenient? That's the question.
I mean, it seems that you're not, so it's not such a strict restriction. You just something missing. You give a list of three to go. It may or may not be all inclusive. using the exceptions, everything else is everyone else is okay, or anyone besides this category is okay. And then even if they do it with supervision, it's okay. So that's not the same by, actually, I can't think of any particular example now, but there is a lot of it. It wouldn't be the same for like a blue value, it would be the same for pollution.
Okay, so you're hitting on an interesting point, which I'm going to mention later, but let's mention now because we're alluding to it. And I think this is the latest point about different matters. I'm going to also be familiar with this, that maybe the other direction, we're saying we should be more lenient for a matter, but maybe I should say it the opposite way, that if you were to categorize something as a matter as opposed to a mitzvah, you're going to say that a mitzvah is something which has inherent value, and a matir is basically just a step to make something permissible, which is otherwise not. So, what difference would there be between putting it in category A or category B? You recall something, so Maury suggested that you could be more mako by a matir, but that sounds a little tricky. So, forgive me for suggesting that there's more the opposite direction. But there are those who suggest, and there's a Tosfos that raises this point, that even without the Tosfos, you could probably think this logically, that maybe a difference would be that a matir is essentially all or nothing. And if you want to know if something is usable or not, if a problem has been resolved, so it either has been resolved, it hasn't been resolved. While when it comes to a mitzvah may actually have more flexibility to have gray areas, or to have what we call, right, exactly, to have a concept of b'di'evet, with achilas and b'di'evet. Now we know that in halacha, we very often invoke that kind of terminology. That l'chadchila, ideally you should do something, and that's going to be actually the topic of the whole first omit here, but that l'chadchila you should do something in a certain way, but the b'di'evet is still acceptable in other ways. Now that terminology is not always used the same way in every kind of context. So to apply it to chulin here for a second, so there are those who suggest that, what do we do with this idea that you become involved in Sakh, if you become a Jewish rabbi, so very often people get very frustrated when they say, okay, I want to know what to do. What are you telling me? It's better this way. Yeah, it's okay this way, but it's better that way. They want to know yes or no, black and white. Is this good or is this not good? Question about that? Very possible. Hold that thought for a second. Just to explain this point about it, because we'll come back to that. But just in terms of this matzah mitzvah point, that when it comes to halacha in general, so people usually want to know, tell me, is it good or is it good? So all the more so if it's about a matzah. And so you want to know. So it either is or isn't. Either I solved the problem or I didn't solve the problem. What are you telling me, l'chadchila, b'di'evet? Well, it's better to do it this way, but b'di'evet is still good. There are those among the Rishonim who maintain that the whole concept doesn't make sense if you're talking about a matir. Matir's got to be black and white. It either is or isn't. If you're going to tell me that there's a concept of l'chadchila and b'di'evet, the some Rishonim maintain that that whole concept doesn't exist on a Torah level at all. It only exists on a level of the Drabbani, which is interesting, and then maybe that will come back to next week in Parsha Shofim, because it ties into some Shofim topics. We get as much synergy as possible, trying to get as many overlapping topics. But it could be, there's some Rishonim who maintain that by Torah law you don't have this open, everything is all or nothing. But others maintain, and there's a story here that we can relate to, that, well, that is what kind of mitzvah we're talking about. If something is a means to an end, so then it either is or isn't. And there's no in-between. While when it comes to something that is a mitzvah, a value. Okay, so then we could say there's more value and there's less value. That ideally you should do a mitzvah in a perfect way and get everything you can out of the experience. But if you can't, or if you did it already and it's not something you can do again, it's okay, at least the basic obligation you fulfill. And you can hear, if you're going to call something valuable, then we can start talking about distinctions. There's the most value you can get, and then there's at least the basic minimal value that we need to say what it's something. So there are those who draw that distinction. And again, you can come to it from a source perspective as opposed to a Zemida, or you can come to it from a logical perspective. You can hear why you would say that it either works or doesn't work when we're talking about a matzah, but a mitzvah that has some kind of inherent value to it. So then that should be done in a ideal way. If not, there's also still value to it. Right, exactly. That the goals would make, I'm not saying that everyone says this, but there is a strong logic to say exactly that a matir is binary, it's black and white, and a mitzvah may be not. So then the question could be, so when it comes to shechita, does shechita give itself to lechachilas and b'diavad? So you might say, well, I think if you can get to the Gemara yet, but only ask for the Mishnah. But you'll say, okay, well, if I go 2 lines into the Gemara, I'll see that clearly that it sounds like there's lechachilas and b'diavad when it comes to shechita. Because Gemara starts interpreting the Mishnah as saying that, okay, theoretically you could be kosher for a cotton to chef if he's supervised, but only b'diavad lechachila you shouldn't set that up. Okay, there's your answer. That lechachila and b'diavad apply to shechita. But there's different kinds of lechachilas and b'diavad. Here we're talking about policy. Saying that as a matter of policy, you shouldn't really do this, because we're showing and discuss why not. What exactly are you concerned about? See, it's a topic for later, but we're showing and address, you know, if you're going to know one way or another whether the shkita is good, so then why should we say it's even though chasila not to have the type of chef? We'll watch and we'll see whether it was done well. So we're showing and discuss what the problem is. Maybe it's a problem with Baal Pashka, maybe it's another problem. But well, when we talk about lechachila and b'diavad here, we're essentially talking about policy. We're not saying that there's a real halachic lechachila and b'diavad. Saying that it's bad policy to have the cut and chef, but if he does, okay, the mice is no different than if a adult chef. So this sugi here doesn't necessarily tell us about lechachila and b'diavad by shechita. But there's another concept which I put on the monotone, but we didn't get to it yet, but you'll see it tomorrow, hopefully. But to look together for a second, on Dav Chazayin and Amaralis, so we're told there, the Mishnah talks about how you chef, and the idea that there are simonim. By oath, you have to chef one simon, by a behema, there's two. And the din is that we have rubo kukulo, but if you chef most of the simon, chef 51% of the simon, so that's acceptable. But apparently, what's going to emerge is that lechatchila, you should chef the whole simon. We don't recommend you chefing 51%. We recommend you chefing 100%. But if it was 51%, it is acceptable. So there, you'll get to see, there is a machlokis among the Rishonim, or different impressions among the Rishonim. Is that a policy issue? But essentially you're saying, listen, how likely is it if you're aiming for 51%, how likely is it you're going to get exactly 51%? So it's not really a great idea to say, I'm going to make it my plan to cut 51% of the seminar. You should make it your plan to cut 100% of the seminar. And then if it ends up being 51%, okay, that's acceptable. So maybe that's also like this stuff, it's a policy issue. Maybe it's more than that. Maybe there is, and this is something that the Achronim were concerned with, or thought was interesting, that maybe there was a mitzvah min ha-Torah to chef the whole thing. So that seems to, if that's the position, again, different Achronim say it differently, but that seems to suggest that there's some religious value here. It's not just chefing to get the behemoth to a permissible state, but that there's a better way to do it than an acceptable way to do it. And it could be mutter with less, And yet, there's something on top of it. So that itself presents an interesting possibility. So there's a lot more to say about this. So I just want to recap because in a minute we're going to have an info. So just to give a little bit of an overview of what we've seen so far and to try to orient us for tomorrow, because the same list, I think, for most of you says that the list still has what to be seen. So today's list, especially, again, it's a shorter Seder and shorter Shiur tomorrow, so today's list should get us to tomorrow. But just to recap and to put us in a direction for tomorrow, so we've seen that the question could be asked, should be asked, before we start fooling, what is Shechita about? Where does it fit into our religious value system? Is it just something that is a means to an end? Is it something that has its own themes and its own value to it? Is it somewhere in between? And that might be a good reason to start the Masechta with the din of Hakol Shofrin, because we know that throughout the Torah, mitzvot do have limitations. Some people are chayav in mitzvot, some people aren't. Some people can create a religious halos and other people can't. So by picking up the topic of who can shecht, it's relevant to that topic, and the Mishnah first seems to exclude those who are puzzled from mitzvot, but then goes on to say that it's not the reason why they're excluded. They're excluded for a practical reason, and that already is addressing this question. So then the issue of how exactly is this conceived, we talked a little bit about the whole endeavor of counting mitzvot, and there's always the question, why do we bother counting mitzvot? And we're assuming that there is a relevance. There's both a philosophical and sometimes a practical difference to counting a mitzvot. You count the mitzvot because you think that has some inherent significance. It's not just something that happened. It'll go to your definition of what a mitzvah is. You know, it's also something that we've shown and debated. The Rambam and the Ramban, for example, debating on what should count and the like. But it all revolves around this question of what is the impact of a certain concept that the Torah describes. Is it something that we should do, something that we need to do under certain circumstances, or something that's only a means to an end or somewhere in between? And as far as who has actively commented on this, so we saw a few Rishonim who took over its stand. We saw the Rambam counts it both in Sefer HaMitzvos and mentions it as a mitzvah of the Shechita. And we saw that the Raizig questions it in Sefer HaMitzvos and says it's only a lav abad mechal asei, which is how some of the Bali HaPosus also saw it. And the Posus Mishvus, close to its close, says it's less than that, it's amatir. And it doesn't even get counted as a lav abad mechal asei, it's only a means to an end. And I have to say more, there are additional opinions we haven't got to yet, but among the impact that it's going to have is this something that should be viewed as relevant to distinctions of the Chakila and the other? That was basically one point that we got to, that there's a strong logic and also basis in the Shaman to say that if something is a matir, then it's not necessarily going to be subject to distinction, it's black and white. Levy pointed out that there are different matirs in Halacha that have different status to it, but it sounds like that's going to be a relevant question. And when it comes to Shechita, we saw that Shechita may or may not have L'chachila B'diyavah distinctions. Our Daf talks about L'chachila B'diyavah distinctions, but maybe it's not the same kind of usage. It's not saying that the mitzvah would do it more, but saying that it's a matter of policy, and there's certain attitudes that are wiser. And then we saw that the din of Shechita's Kol HaSim and L'chachila comes up on Daf Chav Zayin. So that also is subject to discussion. Is that a matter of policy, or is that saying there's some mitzvah value to do it a certain way? And of course, it's been alluded to, and this will be a major topic we'll try to address tomorrow, but the question of the bracha is going to certainly be very large in our discussion. Everyone agrees that there is a bracha in Shechita, so what do you make of that? The fact that there is a bracha here, does that mean that it is an affirmative value? Does that mean that it's more than just a simple means to an end? Or is that got some other meaning behind it? All of that we will try to take a look at tomorrow. So I wish everyone a wonderful day.